From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made when a psychiatrist was treating a patient with schizophrenia. Dr. Elizabeth Ford has spent most of her career working with patients at Bellevue Hospital's prison ward, and that's where people incarcerated at New York City's Rikers Island Jail are sent when they become too sick or violent to stay in the jail. Dr. Ford was providing a second opinion for a patient who wasn't taking his medication. She and her colleagues were trying to determine if they'd need to go to a judge to force medication on him. Dr. Ford was, in her words, very pregnant at the time, and she and her colleagues were standing on one side of the room while the patient was at the other end. Without warning, he picked up a plastic chair and threw it across the room at her. Everyone rushed out of the room in a panic. Dr. Ford says she wanted to be brave, be a leader, be the person who would figure out what to do next. So she quietly walked out of the room, and when she returned, she calmly talked to the patient. When he finally opened up, he told her, quote, "No pregnant lady should stand. I was offering you a chair." That's when Dr. Ford thought, how can I be angry at this man who was trying to be kind and compassionate in his own way toward me? The incident symbolizes her work with imprisoned patients who struggle with mental health issues. She works with men and women who have been accused and convicted of horrible crimes, people accused of killing strangers and even children, people who have been labeled as the most dangerous to society. Her work involves getting to the root of the trauma that so many of these individuals have experienced in their lives. She says they've endured family trauma, poverty, a lack of education. She writes about her experiences and her work in her book, Sometimes Amazing Things Happen. And as she has said, the word amazing doesn't always necessarily mean good. It can mean surprising. Dr. Ford is in Rochester today for a presentation at the Rochester Academy of Medicine. But first, she joins us on Connections to discuss the groundbreaking work she's done that shows just how prevalent mental illness is in the criminal justice system. We'll also hear her ideas about how to treat it and what the role of the system should be in rehabilitating people who are incarcerated. Dr. Ford, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
Well, I think it is not a surprise to listeners that mental illness is common in the prison setting. I think the prevalence, the commonalities, the common threads, and then the question of whether we're doing really anything at all to rehabilitate, broadly speaking, are going to be at the core of this conversation. I want to ask you, first and foremost, who you wrote that book for and what you hope would come out of it.
Yeah, I've thought a lot about that, actually. And initially, my answer would have been, I wrote that book for the patients to try somehow to give them a voice, because the patients that I treat and the ones for whom I've devoted my career never have a voice in the public discussion about certainly mass incarceration and also the issues around mental illness and criminal justice. As I was writing the book, and then as I've since been talking about it and thinking about it since it was published, I think I was at least half writing the book for me. Actually, it was very therapeutic to go back and remember and think about and really dig into the emotions and the feelings and really the trauma that we all experienced in that work and to try to make sense of it. And in the making sense of it, it has been enormously helpful for me as a psychiatrist to be able to really understand where the patients have been and really where they can go also.
I think about the times I have, I want to try to kind of paint a little picture without caricaturing, but I'm going to talk about public transport, for example.
Okay.
Anyone who's ever been on public transport, for example, in New York City, might encounter someone who is exhibiting what appears to be a symptom, an outward symptom of mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's not to broad brush or characterize, but there's, you know, tens of thousands of people every single day, for example, just in Manhattan who are riding or mm-hmm. just in the New York City area. And when I'm in that moment, I usually find myself wondering, like, what's happened in their lives to bring to this point? Because and this is starting to sound holier than thou, but what I often see around me are people going, like, shut up,
yeah,
or, you know, just kind of mocking,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to thinking, wow, like, it's kind of heartbreaking to see some of these moments. And obviously, you strike me as the kind of person who is spent your life wondering that kind of question.
Mm-hmm.
Is it more productive to kind of try to open our minds and hearts to ask that kind of question?
Oh, I think it's always productive to wonder and wonder about things and be curious about people, behavior. I think it was totally spot on, your description about the subway in New York City. But I don't think that most of the public's tendency to look the other way or to attribute bad things to whatever that person is doing comes necessarily from a place of sort of not caring. I think it comes from a place of not understanding mm-hmm. and then being afraid of what you don't understand. If you're not asking the next step and the next question, which is what is going on, we're never going to get to the point where we're going to fix anything. You don't have to have an answer, but just to be curious. Honestly, I think that's an important step, and it's hard for a lot of people to do. If you're not personally connected to someone who's been incarcerated or to someone with mental illness, it's very weird and strange.
And so I mentioned some of it at the outset, but why don't you tell our listeners again where you have done a lot of this work, where you've been worked with people, and how that's kind of come about?
Yeah. So I went to medical school not at all planning to be a psychiatrist. My mother is a psychologist, and I was almost schooled in the opposite direction. But I had a number of really critical experiences in medical school that made me think more about the relationship between the doctor and the patient and not just the medicine or the surgical intervention. So that led me to psychiatric residency, which I did in New York City specifically because of Bellevue Hospital. That is, I don't know the Rochester equivalent, but that is the largest public hospital in the city. It takes care of the patients that no other hospital wants, the patients that can't pay, that are immigrants, and that are incarcerated. So I did my training there and got real exposure to these patients, largely because I was one of the few psychiatrists who actually wanted to be doing the work. And that gave me access to a lot of the different kinds of care. I was at Bellevue for 14 years. And then 4.5 years ago was offered the chance, and I really do think it was an opportunity, to move into the jail system proper. And so for the past 4.5 years, I've been the director of mental health for the whole jail system, which includes Rikers Island.
When you are working with an individual, what is that process like and kind of your thought process at trying to maybe get to know this person and understand some of the underlying causes? How does that happen?
Well, it happens a little bit like how I might try to get to know you. I mean, it's very natural and sort of takes the shape now of a conversation with another person. I admittedly was trained as a be neutral and not reveal any of your feelings to your patients. It was a very psychoanalytic sort of model that I was trained in, but it didn't work with my patients. I mean, they wanted me to be very real with them. They didn't necessarily want to talk about the medication choice. They wanted to talk about the trauma they were experiencing in the jail or in their lives. And patients in jail, I would argue patients everywhere, they know when their doctor is not being genuine or not being engaged. I get to know them by talking and listening, the same way I imagine you do or anybody else does.
And obviously, we're going to talk about some of the powerful interactions and stories. Again, with the word amazing doesn't always mean positive. I mean, there's a lot of things. But I also don't want to kind of portray this as, well, everyone you sit down with, it turns out, you know, they have this maybe a sad story, but there can be this heartwarming outcome. You know, in your book, you wrote about one patient for whom you said you thought you had no empathy, that the patient was aggressive, really taxed the staff and other patients. And you mentioned at one point you thought like you didn't really even care what happened to this person and kind of needed a break. Tell me a little bit about that and then maybe how that impacted you.
Yeah. And by the way, that still happens. Mm-hmm. To imply that, I mean, I have empathic failures all the time. It's a daily effort for me to try to sort of practice what I preach with my patients. There are times when, and usually it's after I've been working for years. I mean, this happens over time, burnout, fatigue. I get a little institutionalized in the sense that you get so used to this crazy, weird space that you're not sure what's true or not. And I know that when a patient says something to me, and in my head, I'm rolling my eyes. Hopefully, I'm not rolling my eyes in reality, but the feeling is like, oh God, here we have to go again. Can't you just help yourself? You know, you're doing this to yourself. Those kinds of feelings are not productive. But I do have them. I mean, it's sort of a normal human response to this strange situation you're in.
I think sometimes when we, I say the sort of the collective we. When we think about trying to help those who need help, I can recall moments when I have helped deliver meals for Thanksgiving or donated around the holidays. And there's a wide range of reactions you'll get from people who need the help.
Yes.
And I confess to sort of shamefully looking back and thinking at times, boy, this person didn't really show a whole lot of gratitude. You know, we're delivering meals as if I'm doing it just to get kind of the psychic bump of receiving the gratitude. But that's also a human interaction. And so at least for someone in you in a professional setting, it kind of makes me feel like that's all of us. I mean, like there will be those moments, but it's probably best as best we can to sort of resist them. We're not just there. It's not just going to be this perfect, gratitude and change and then constructive steps forward.
Right.
That anyone can sort of wear down at that.
Absolutely. And also to remember, patients with mental illness are not without the ability to reason or to make decisions, and they have not lost their humanity. And I think it's unfortunate. Psychiatry is not particularly helped in this regard, but to think, if someone has schizophrenia, I have to treat them so differently. They won't be able to take care of themselves. And I think if you come at a patient from the point of thinking they are weak and helpless rather than let's find the strengths and focus on that, it's disrespectful to the patients and to their autonomy. And I think similar to helping people in need, they may not be grateful. They may need the help and be very ashamed about it. Hmm.
Dr. Elizabeth Ford, our guest, who's the author of Sometimes Amazing Things Happen, and should tell you that today, from 3 to 7 at the Rochester Academy of Medicine, Dr. Ford will be there for a book talk, an event that will include some live music, the amazing, and there's another word, great use for amazing, Daniel Ponder will be there. East High School's TLI student poets are going to be there. It should be a wonderful event. Sometimes when you hear Rochester Academy of Medicine, you think academy, it's just a building. It's on South Avenue, 3 to 7 today. And so it should be an outstanding event there. And that's why Dr. Ford's in town. And that's why we've been able to convince her to come in here. Let's talk a little bit about what we commonly see and what your observations tell you. So do we know roughly in terms of, I don't know if there's a percentage or an actual number on this, the percentage of people incarcerated for violent crime, for example, what percentage do you think are living with mental illness?
Well, if you had taken away the violent crime classifier, I could tell you that easily. So
let's take that out then. Yeah. Start there.
Because actually a lot of people with mental illness aren't charged with or convicted of violent crimes. But in general, in the criminal justice system, the working percentage is roughly 20% with serious mental illness. So that includes schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, PTSD in some cases, and major depression. So these are serious illnesses. If you expand it to the whole full range of mental illness, including things like anxiety disorders, the rates can go upwards of 50%. So it's huge. And just as by comparison, community rates are roughly 3 to 5% for serious mental illness and somewhere around 20% for all mental illness combined.
That our listeners will maybe stop and go, wait a second, 3 to 5% community rate for serious mental illness. Isn't all mental illness serious? So how did you sort of stratify?
Yeah, so great question. It's actually an unfortunate terminology, serious mental illness, but it's a way to distinguish mental illness that, for the most part, requires medication for stability, often leads to hospitalizations in individuals, and really has been shown over time to have a significant impact, not just on one's quality of life, but one's actual lifespan. And then there are many other illnesses, which of course cause great disability and distress, but that may not require hospitalization. They may not require medications. And so those groups of illnesses are categorized as less intense.
All right, so 3 to 5% serious mental illness classification for the general public, 20% total mental illness for the general public of some kind.
Correct.
Okay. And then in an incarcerated population, upwards of 50% all mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
But how much would you put in that serious category?
About 20.
About 20.
Depending on the institution. That's a
great deal. That's a lot. And how much of that population before your intervention or before this part of their lives have ever had serious intervention, medication, treatment, and help?
If I had the answer to that question, that would be great. We don't know. The answer is we don't know. In general, in jail settings, people with serious mental illness who are arrested and detained have had very little or discontinuous, meaning not with the same person, treatment. And that's oftentimes led to the symptoms that are related to their arrest. So healthcare in general is not particularly robust for this group.
What kind of breakthroughs have you seen?
Oh, I've seen a lot. Although, as you say about the amazing, I've also seen sort of many things that aren't breakthroughs.
And I know your book, too, so let's kind of talk about that spectrum. But let's start with the stuff that really kind of should put a little hop on our step to give us some hope.
Yeah. And I should say that in the book, and as I talk about patients, I'm very careful not to reveal anything that would identify those patients. So as I answer your question, I'm going to be telling you common scenarios that a number of people have gone through. But so an example would be an adolescent, unfortunately, young, 16 and up until very recently were in the jail. So young man with emerging schizophrenia, no treatment before, admitted into the jail. His symptoms weren't recognized, so he was aggressive, not sleeping, getting into a lot of fights, very impulsive, and to many people just seemed like an obnoxious teenager who was disciplined frequently. And he started to get involved with an art therapy group in the jail. And then over the course of his detention in the jail, which it was unfortunately several years, he continued to participate in this art therapy group, and he displayed his work in a gallery downtown in Manhattan while he was incarcerated. We've been able to do that as part of the stuff we're doing in the jail. And he's now a galleried artist on his own, outside of jail. And he's helping and mentoring other individuals who have gone through that situation. And he was really struggling with, I don't know if it was formerly PTSD, but traumatic symptoms that were leading to the way he was behaving. So that's an example. I've seen countless men, largely men, that's the population that I have treated the most, with schizophrenia who have been written off as lost causes. There's no medicine that will help them. And that's because every time they come into the jail, nobody knows what's going on with them. They get sort of treatment that's mixed and nothing works. But when you have a block of time with them, usually it's months, get them on the right medication, get them connected to care in the community, it can be really amazing. I've seen not a lot, but I say in the course of my career, 6 or 7 patients I've formerly treated who I thought, this is going to be a difficult life for them. Like out in the world, I've run into them on the streets around the hospital doing beautifully. But those times are, they're not frequent. And I think that's part of what makes this work really hard. You have to know that the hopeful, triumphant times are going to be less than the times that don't feel so good. I don't know. In my opinion, though, that's worth it.
Sure. And is there one form of mental illness that's the most common that you come across?
Serious mental illness? Yeah, in the jail system, it's probably schizophrenia.
I wanted to ask this in a way that is sensitive and not to say these are lost causes. As you say, that's a very dangerous term, and people who end up incarcerated often run into that assumption.
Yep.
But are there forms of mental illness that are more challenging to kind of work through, to medicate, to kind of stabilize?
Yes, and unfortunately, schizophrenia common and also very difficult to treat. I shouldn't say difficult to treat. Schizophrenia, I would say, and bipolar disorder, both difficult to treat in a setting where there's ongoing trauma, where there's chaos, where the rules are difficult to interpret, where it's hard to control things. Treatment, frankly, of any mental illness is tough in that situation, but if you add on illnesses where an individual's reality is impaired to begin with, it becomes extremely challenging. And there's the biggest issue that we face as psychiatrists is that the patients don't trust us. And it's hard to have a therapeutic interaction when one person in that dyad doesn't trust the other.
Do you have moments where there is at least some relief to get a diagnosis? I ask this because, you know, I'm someone who, I remember when I was 17 and I was diagnosed with migraines when they were about to give me a spinal tap. I went, well, thank goodness you got this.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't any fun to deal with migraines, but at least it's good to know.
Yeah.
I have a friend who has Asperger's syndrome, wasn't diagnosed until the age of 26, and that was hard. He said, how could no one have come to me and, like, help me see this?
Yeah.
Again, that's not to say Asperger's, but just certain aspects of his life were more easily explained in that context.
Of course.
Are there moments of at least relief that, you know, this is going to be difficult, but knowing this is helpful?
Almost universally.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. Even diagnosed, there in the mental illness world, there are diagnoses that are not, that sort of carry their own double stigma. And even those diagnoses, patients frequently are like, oh, at least there's a name for this. At least I'm not alone in this. At least you understand something about what I'm going through. And for my life so far, people have just told me I'm a jerk, or they tell me I have to stop fighting, or whatever it is. Yeah, it's enormously relieving. Similar, and which is a little paradoxical, to when an individual in jail is sentenced to prison time. It can be enormously relieving, because at least you know what's going to happen. At least you're not sitting in this jail world where you don't know when you're getting out. You don't know what's going to happen with your case. You don't know who the next person coming in the jail is going to be, and maybe they're going to victimize you. But when you know you're going to prison, you know what to expect. And that often relieves a lot of anxiety.
So largely speaking with the American penal system, how much do you think it really is geared toward rehabilitation or treatment, as opposed to just sort of incarceration and a punitive aspect? How far do we have to go on that scale?
Well, we have to go very far. My reading of the history is that these institutions were in fact designed and were to some degree rehabilitative, in the 1700s, 1800s. We've done a complete 180 on that. And I think that it's still absolutely possible for correctional institutions to actually be rehabilitative. But our society as a whole has to come to some consensus about how we feel about these people.
Yeah. And in our second half hour, we're going to spend more time on that, because that's really a big question. I mean, there's some non-zero part of the population that would say, hey, they did something wrong. Send them to prison. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't be coddling. We shouldn't. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we'll talk about that in our second half hour. And we'll also talk about how Dr. Ford sees the avenue for really improving what rehabilitation looks like in an incarcerated setting. Go back a little bit on the history, though. You say in your read of history, kind of the earlier days, there it was more about this. How so?
So I'll give you an example of solitary confinement. So initially, that process being locked in a separate space away from all human beings was initially, I believe, a religious exercise for monks as a way to get very centered, to really think about whatever issues they needed to tackle. And that it was thought to be highly rehabilitative. Whatever we know about it now, at the time, it was seen as a helpful, useful tool. And when it was introduced in prisons, it was designed for that reason. So the intention really was that they would think about what's going on, that they would be away from all of the stimulation and chaos in the jail, and that it would be restful. Now, I think we've learned that that practice is not helpful, but the intention was there. And I think we've lost that intention. I think we've lost the intention, and that's really the challenge.
That will be a theme in our second half hour. Let me get a listener's email on this. CT writes to us to say, many troubled young people have experienced early childhood trauma and develop not just PTSD, but also reactive attachment disorder, which does not allow them to trust and often makes them unable to feel empathy.
Mm-hmm.
Having helped raise a young man who was positive he would be in jail or dead by age 19, I've seen this firsthand, and luckily so far he's now almost 21, has a job and a girlfriend, and we keep our fingers crossed that he keeps progressing.
That's fabulous to hear.
Yeah, thank you, CT, for that. Now, reactive attachment disorder?
So I'm not an expert in child psychiatry, but as it's described in that email, that's fairly accurate.
Okay. if we were to find the most common thread in the personal stories of the mostly men that you have worked with, what is it? A lack of parental attachment going back to childhood, some kind of trauma, abuse, neglect?
Yeah, it's the trauma. And trauma is broad strokes, but trauma is almost universal. Maybe it is. It's universal in the patients that we see in the jail. And trauma is not just outright physical or sexual abuse. It's emotional neglect. It's absent parents for whatever reason. They may, in fact, be incarcerated. But it's also the cultural and institutional trauma that can come from poverty and racism and being told and being made to feel that you're less than for your entire life. That over time is very traumatizing and can lead to many of the symptoms that person who sent the email just described.
PTSD is something that you even maybe have experienced yourself.
I have, yes.
Tell us
yes,
about that.
Yes, and I continue to be in therapy to make sure that I keep it sort of well controlled. For me, well, first of all, I didn't recognize it for a long time. Dr. Heal yourself, I was not so great at that. nor was there actually a diagnosis for it in the old manners, because I had never been, that I was aware of, attacked or abused in any kind of overt way. But over time, it became clear that the exposure to other people's trauma, hearing the stories, and then also really witnessing the things that happen in the jail and to the patients had taken its toll on me. And there was a period of time just a couple of years ago where I actually had to stop working for a little bit because I was re-experiencing things. I could not sleep. I was at that point we had talked about before where I didn't care about my patients anymore. And I was not being the mother or the wife that I wanted to be. It's pretty awful. I mean, just thinking about it and I have all the privilege that these patients don't have. So I was experiencing this being able to access good help and having a supportive family and having a job and a good education and being white, frankly. So to imagine all of going through that without the advantages is really awful.
You get to one point where you couldn't even really see what a newspaper might
oh,
say.
Oh, yeah. Well, I have to say I'm still at that point.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. The Times, my husband will screen the front page of the Times just to make sure that there's not something about patients in the jail or something that are in the headlines. But for the most part, I stay away from a whole lot of media. It's very hard. I re-experience things. I cry. I have a hard time containing the emotion that is associated with like the deep despair that I see in what I read.
So on one side, your avoidance of media comes just from sort of self-protection, mm-hmm. and the way those stories are associated with some of the hardest parts of the work that you're doing. I'm also curious to know if you think the media covers these issues well.
It's a good question. I was actually just at I have a colleague in the Columbia School of Journalism who asked that exact same question, and I think given the access that the media gets, they probably do cover it fairly well. And they're different conservative or liberal media outlets, and they'll cover it differently. But I think the biggest challenge that we face in having these systems be transparent is that the systems don't want to be transparent, and they really don't have to be. So the things that happen behind bars are largely shielded from everybody. And it's very hard to get access to that. Even FOIA requests don't always lead to the information that will help a journalist really understand what's going on. And many departments of correction, New York City not so much, but won't allow journalists in. People who have been incarcerated are often hesitant to talk about their experiences. So I think it's a lack of access rather than a particular way that it's covered.
So let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back in our second half hour. We'll talk more about how the system might change. If we put Dr. Ford in charge of redesigning an entire system... It's a lot of power we're about to put in your hands here. She is the author of Sometimes Amazing Things Happen. And the book is there's so much humanity in this work, her approach and what she has brought to prison settings, the people she's worked with, and now the general public in helping understand this. So listeners, whether you're in the camp that says, well, prison's supposed to be punitive, it's supposed to be hard, it's supposed to be a deterrent, or whether you're in the camp that says, look at the recidivism rate, look at how inefficient it is, look at just basic what justice ought to be like, there's a lot of divergent views, but I think this is going to be useful and helpful for everybody. There's an event today hosted by the Group Foundation for Mental Health. It's happening from 3 to 7 today at the Rochester Academy of Medicine. That's on South Avenue. Dr. Ford will be there. The book will be there. She's going to be talking about that. And there's going to be music. Daniel Ponder, it's always great. East High School's TLI student poets will be there. So an event starting this afternoon at the Rochester Academy of Medicine. Let's get that break and come right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, Governor Andrew Cuomo joins us on Connections for the first time. He's our guest for the hour, and we have a wide range of issues to discuss. We should warn you, it's a pre-recorded conversation. We recorded it just this morning, but no opportunity for listeners to interact. But it is a chance for us to hear from the governor at length on everything from his endorsement in the race for president to economic development, his frustration with Democrats who he thinks are sometimes unrealistic about big issues, and more. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Listeners, for the rest of the hour, if you want to email the program or call, you can do that, connections@wxxi.org. Or you can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. At the heart of this conversation is how we think about the humanity of people who have been incarcerated and what happens in their lives, what has already happened in their lives, what happens going forward. And if you want to boil it down to efficiency and sort of whether a system is working, that's part of the question. But when we've talked about things like solitary confinement, we've had some very strong opinions voiced via phone calls and listeners. You can do that if you want to as well. I will ask Dr. Ford now. I mean, for the listeners who have called in the past, when we have talked about, for example, solitary confinement, we hear this sort of this sentiment that says, lock him up and lock him up for even longer. And it's not about a cushy prison environment. It's not about how you feel. It's about what you've done. Generally, when you hear that sentiment, I certainly suspect that you don't share it, but what do you say to it?
Well, I do share it. I mean, when somebody is aggressive to me or when I see somebody hurt someone I love, I have that impulse too. I mean, that I think that's also a human impulse, right?
Absolutely.
So what I also have been able to do, and I think everyone has the capacity to do, is to not act on that initial emotional feeling, to let it be, and then to take the next step, as we spoke about before, and sort of be curious about it. I absolutely respect that people feel that way about it. What has happened for me is that I have seen firsthand the effects of something like solitary confinement on a human being. And I think if we are okay saying everybody should just be punished and we don't actually care what happens to them afterwards, then that stance makes a lot of sense. But if we do collectively want people to be able to be their best selves, that approach is not helpful. And I am a strong opponent of solitary confinement. I don't think it's helpful. I don't think it deters behavior. And in fact, I think it makes patients much worse when they come out.
Okay. And so, during our brief break, Dr. Ford's going, you're really going to ask me to redesign the whole system? No, not in any serious way. But if policymakers bring you into the room and they said, give us the first 1, 2, 3 steps that we can take that really start putting the system in a direction that you think is not just more humane, but more effective. What are those changes?
They're all about interacting with the person who's coming into the jail, which I know sounds sort of Pollyanna-ish and pie in the sky, but I think if the correction officers, the security staff, are trained and have experience and are hired because they want to help people, which many of them are actually, but who are also given the skills and the support in their organization to help individuals, And if when the police arrest people, instead of seeing that arrest as, oh, this person did a very bad thing, let's punish them. Oh, this person did a very bad thing. What's going on in their life that led them to do this? And I think you could say that for really pretty much every crime. This is a warning sign. And how can, when they're coming into the jail, what are the things in that person's life that we can try to help them with for when they get out? Because right now what's happening is, as you described, people are coming in and there's not a lot of thought about what the next step is going to be. 95% of the people who are incarcerated are going to be out in the world. And it's really just, it's a change in mindset. I don't think it's hard. New York City has made really pretty phenomenal strides in this department. And that's, you know, Rikers Island is probably the most notorious jail in the world. And it has made some substantial changes. So if Rikers can get better, it seems to me that most places can.
Is there any danger, either social danger or et cetera, for patients who show vulnerability in group therapy in prison settings?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, yes. And that's why it's so important that group therapy is done by individuals who are trained in it and can recognize those risks. Group therapy, in my mind, is perhaps one of the most effective interventions in jails and prisons because it forces people to be vulnerable and to be in a community with individuals that they may not like, they may not know, and they may feel threatened by. But that also sort of mimics like the real world. You're not always in settings where everybody is supporting you. But yes, it is. It's a barrier that people have to overcome, that we have to overcome, the risk of disclosing information and then being victimized.
Disclosing information, becoming victimized. Interesting.
Yeah,
not just sort of the stigma with showing sort of emotional vulnerability.
Well, there's that, but the very real issue and that what people worry about less is emotional vulnerability and more is this person going to steal my PIN card?
Yeah.
Are they going to know that, you know, I really want to see my daughter and they're going to hold that over me somehow? Like, those are the kinds of things people worry about.
Okay. What about that side, though, of emotional vulnerability? I mean, the notion that, human beings need to feel loved in their lives. They need to feel loved early on in their lives. They need to feel some kind of a secure attachment to a parental figure and a reliability mm-hmm. and a comfort. And mm-hmm. and I certainly suspect a lot of people who end up incarcerated have not always had that and maybe at
Correct.
Some point have given up on the idea of feeling and showing and receiving love. Can that
Correct.
Change over time?
Oh, absolutely. Like, the human brain has endless capabilities to shift and change based on the environment. Not everything is set in stone by the time you're 20. So absolutely, it may take a long time. I mean, granted, it could take someone 50 years to get to that point. But yeah, totally.
Are there moments where you start to see it crack a little bit? Someone is letting you in a little bit?
Oh, yeah. So it's those moments when, you know, if you're teetering on burnout, mm-hmm. like pulls you right back in and you think, oh my God, this is what I've been needing as a doctor. But yeah. So, plenty of examples of that. Most commonly, a patient's just not talking to you for, it could be weeks or months. And then they make eye contact. And then they'll go into a room and sit with you, even if they don't say anything. And then they'll start talking. And they're testing the safety of the relationship. I mean, that's what's going on.
But maybe don't even have the sort of emotional facility to even know that, right?
I mean, right.
Because sometimes the privilege for an outsider, someone outside of that system like myself would be, well, eventually they'll realize that what they lacked was love growing up, and it's okay, and it's okay, as opposed to, you know, realizing how much neglect and trauma has caused over the years. I think you told Terry Gross that earlier in your career, you didn't realize how many people in the criminal justice system were neurologically delayed, didn't have the education or cognitive ability to navigate the system.
Right.
You talked about a patient who kind of banged his head against the wall as a way to self-soothe, which is, that's almost a caricature that people have, but it has happened.
It's a real phenomenon, absolutely.
And so without that, with that neurological delay and development and then the lack of ability to navigate a complex system to begin with, that's just another handicap that I don't know how we create a system where recidivism doesn't happen for people who are not incarcerated anymore, who have those struggles, mm-hmm. or who at least have a decent quality of life and a chance to move forward in some sort of stable and productive way.
Well, I don't have the answer to that either, 100%. But so take the example of somebody who's banging their head. If the response is to tell them to keep banging their head because it's annoying everybody, that will have a different impact than, wait a second, what's going on? Or removing them from the thing that they're banging their head against. I mean, those are two, it seems like a simple difference, but leads to dramatic results. Hmm.
Gary writes to us to say, let us agree that solitary confinement as a punishment is egregiously wrong and harmful. Many in special housing units are there because they are a threat to the general population of other inmates. How would your guest prefer inmates who are dangerous to others be handled?
So we have taken the approach in the New York City system for the past couple of years where people with serious mental illness who have committed a serious act of violence in the jail, so usually it's an assault, a serious assault or a stabbing, who otherwise would be in solitary confinement, they are on specialized housing units that are run largely by the Mental Health Service, where there's nobody locked in. It looks much like a hospital unit. The staff are on the units. The officers are specially trained. There's group therapy throughout the day, individual therapy. And the violence rates there are greatly reduced. And those patients are not locked in their cells at all. So I would argue that there is an alternative approach. It requires a lot of attention and focus and supervision, for sure, but not impossible.
More in the way of resources, in other words.
Yes.
And more of an investment.
Yeah, more of an investment. I mean, I would argue that saving a person's life or reducing their risk of being seriously injured is I don't know if there's a price on that one.
No, I hear that. Let me get a phone call from Kalia in Rochester. Go ahead, Kalia.
Hi. Thank you, Evan. Hi, Dr. Ford.
Hi.
Very, very interesting conversation, and thank you for doing this. I have some interest. I have a good friend whose daughter, after being jailed a few times for behavior, has ended up in prison for 11 years, and she's been there 5 years now. She won't get out till she's 35, and it was discovered that she has bipolar disorder, which was suspected in high school, and I grew up with this little girl on my street. Mm-hmm. There were some issues, but I'm very curious, and I think about it a lot. How is there any information and statistics, you know, statistics about how do they do when they get out? I mean, it's been discovered she's being medicated. She's doing really well, but she ended up in prison. You know, she was threatening people's lives and with weapons. And where does that part of the person go once you address the mental health issue? But does it go away? I don't really mean that, but how do they do? And I certainly will take my answer from the show. I don't have to stay on the phone with
okay.
you here.
Kalia,
I know you're almost done.
Oh, yeah. No, thank you. I'm really glad you called. Thank you very much. Go ahead, Dr. Ford.
Yeah. So to answer the question about how do patients who have mental illness do when they leave the jail or the prison, there's not great research about that. And I'll just tell the audience that there's not great research or data about how people who are incarcerated fare generally. There are serious restrictions on research for people who are incarcerated for good reasons, because it's been abused over the course of our country's history. With respect to, I'm not sure if this was part of your question, but it sounded like part of it was, what if the violence or the criminal behavior is not a function of the mental illness? So if you treat the illness, is there some underlying behavior there that may lead to an arrest? And I think that that's always a possibility. Mental illness is not in no way the cause of most violence in this country. And there are lots of reasons that people become aggressive or do bad, you know, do things that are criminal, that are based on their life situation and their development and less about their mental illness. However, treatment is always an important part for anybody who's got mental illness.
I've heard sort of divergent views on the idea that it requires mental illness before someone can pick up a weapon and injure or kill a large number of people in a group setting, in a mass setting. Does that require mental illness?
No, I don't think it requires mental illness, although it's I don't think it's completely telling the whole story to say that mental illness never contributes to these. And there have mass shootings, school shootings, horribly tragic. And I do think individuals who are involved in that have a much higher risk and percentage of mental illness, but it is not a requirement.
On the subject of violence, I think you've written that it's really when patients get scared that they could become violent, that whatever stigma we have as a society about mental illness and violence, which we've been discussing over the last few minutes and probably can't be discussed enough because of that stigma, fear often can lead to violence. And that in a way of sort of cutting that, there are moments where you'll let a patient know when you're afraid?
Oh, yes. But I mean, most violence is a result of fear.
Fear.
You don't have to have mental illness for that. And people become aggressive because they're afraid they're going to get hurt, or they're afraid their loved one or their possess. Fear is what drives violence pretty much all the time. An approach that I didn't realize was going to be effective, but that I did, frankly, because I didn't know what else to do, is really being open and honest with the person you're afraid of. It disarms them enormously.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, you need to sort of be thinking about all the potential ramifications, but I have never been in a situation where a patient has laughed at me or has become more aggressive after I reveal how I'm feeling. And also, they know it. Right? My face is getting red, or I'm backing away. So to just acknowledge and to be honest with them about how I'm feeling, I think is sort of an olive branch to them and is really helpful.
Have you found any patients who you think are beyond rehabilitation?
You probably won't believe me, but I think my answer is no. I don't think I have.
I believe it.
Had I stopped working in this field 10 years ago, my answer probably would have been different. But with the experience of now seeing, in 20 years, I've seen patients progress over that time period, and sometimes it's taken them 19 years to do it. But haven't met anybody like that yet.
No, I believe it. I mean, there are times where people will say, well, Evan, some people's minds are just so closed that they will never change their mind about politics or social issues. And I say, I do not believe that any mind is totally unpersuadable.
I agree.
And over time, I've seen now it's not a perfect parallel to rehabilitation of a patient with mental illness, but I think we're too often quick to give up. So let me kind of close by asking you what you think we ought to view as a society. If our society was looking at criminal justice and a system of incarceration in a way that is more in line with the values you think we ought to have with it, how should we think about prison? How should we think about that?
Well, I would encourage everyone to look at Scandinavian models of correctional care. They seem to both reduce criminal behavior in the community and also treat the individuals who are there quite compassionately. But first, we should make, if we are going to accept that jails and prisons will exist in this country, the people who are in there should really need to be in there. Right now, there are plenty of people who are facing long prison sentences still from the drug laws that were, from decades ago, or people with serious mental illness in jail for trespassing. I mean, first we have to make sure that the people who are in there we really feel strongly are so dangerous that they can't be out in the world, because that's really the only people who should be incarcerated, in my opinion. And then for those people who are there, I think we actually have to learn what works for them. We don't know that yet. And so to be as therapeutic as possible, to listen, to do the best we can for those individuals and really connect the prisons and the jails to the community so that they're not these black boxes that no one ever knows about. I think things would get better, but really it's the first step of who should be in there.
Dr. Elizabeth Ford has been our guest for the hour, the author of Sometimes Amazing Things Happen. That book is available now, and there's an event today at the Rochester Academy of Medicine. And if I earlier this hour said South Avenue, I meant East Avenue, just a different direction. East Avenue is the location, 1441 East Avenue for the Rochester Academy of Medicine, an event from 3 to 7 today. You can get tickets at the door, and when I say tickets, it's not just a book talk, an event there, live music from Daniel Ponder. If you've never heard Daniel Ponder, Dr. Ford, I'm just going to tell you.
I haven't, but I'm excited.
Oh, my God, it's just phenomenal. An amazing woman, by the way, who's worked in criminal justice, done defense work, and her music often reflects those her values that she brings. So Daniel Ponder will be there. East High School's TLI student poets will be there. Live music, talking about the book, talking about these themes, 3 to 7 today at the Rochester Academy of Medicine. Dr. Ford, thank you for taking the time and to be here with us this hour.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you.
Governor Andrew Cuomo is next on Connections.